Together we will stand, fight and we'll fall. Come on now, people, let's get on the ball and work together. Come on, let's work together.
Do it, children.
Now, now, people, say now, together we will stand. Every boy, girl, woman, and man.
Good morning and welcome to Neighbors. A new feature here on KUMD, helping us navigate the challenging times in which we find ourselves. It was a tough landscape for journalism before the COVID-19 crisis. Now there are all kinds of new complications that are cropping up, whether they are on the air or in the actual newspaper in terms of the actual coverage, or whether it's things going on behind the scenes, small papers shutting down. There was just a story in the Trib about that recently. Journalists' budgets on a shoestring, people concerned about advertising revenue and what's going to happen to these media outlets. Who better to help us take a look at the big picture, the medium picture, and the small picture than Jane Kirtley? She's the Silha Professor of Media Ethics and Law with the Hubbard School of Journalism and Mass Communication at the University of Minnesota, and she's the director of the Silha Center for the Study of Media Ethics and Law. Jane, good morning. What a treat to have you on the line with us this morning.
Well, it's a pleasure. Thank you so much.
The Fairness Doctrine. You were the one that actually clued me into this. I was young and foolish and was unaware that the Fairness Doctrine had been repealed in the 80s. And the idea behind the Fairness Doctrine is if you gave X amount of print space or airtime to one candidate, you needed to give the same to all of the candidates. And if you reported on one side of an issue, you needed to try to report on the other side of an issue. We have been operating without the Fairness Doctrine. Where has that left us in our media landscape?
Well, there are many who would say that the rise of conservative talk radio is directly linked to the abolition of the Fairness Doctrine. Because, and I think it's kind of helpful to keep this in mind, there are really two aspects to the Fairness Doctrine that are relevant here. One is, as you were describing, the fact that if a broadcaster chooses to cover a controversial issue of public importance, that's the way the language read in the statute, then they had an obligation to allow a reasonable opportunity for those of opposing viewpoints to be heard. So if you took on a particular issue, even just straight reporting of that issue, you had an obligation to give those who disagreed with your take on it an opportunity to respond. And so what that meant was that it really wasn't possible to have the kind of, and again, I'm trying to be neutral here, the kind of one-sided rhetoric that we hear on certain AM radio stations. You couldn't really do that because you'd have to devote an entire show to giving those on the other side an opportunity to refute that. With the abolition of the Fairness Doctrine, that obligation went away. And so now that's the landscape that we've been living in now for quite a long time. I mean, as you said, it was abolished in the late 80s, so we're talking a good 30 years now without the Fairness Doctrine. The other aspect, just quickly, of this having to do with pre-election stuff, that has not been completely abolished. That has to do with the whole issue of whether radio and television stations have to allow the purchase of ads by federal political candidates. And if they sell time to one, they have to sell time to his or her opponent. That's still in place.
And that obviously makes good sense. I would imagine that it isn't just journalists who are concerned about this. I know that there are a lot of thinking people that are extremely concerned about this.
It's true, and I mean we have many people, and I would say across the political spectrum, who are concerned about what they see as the rise of, for lack of a better term, partisan media. I mean, if you think back when the Federal Communications Commission, then the Federal Radio Commission, was first created back in the 20s and 30s, the concern then was exactly what has happened now, that you would have powerful owners who would have one particular viewpoint, and they would spew that out on the airwaves. And if you were living in a community where that was your only source of electronic media, you were kind of stuck with that. I mean, it was really almost seen as a proselytizing kind of thing, and I'm not speaking of religion necessarily, although there was a notorious case of one station that engaged in a lot of political rhetoric that was garbed in religious rhetoric. But be that as it may, I think you're right that today's young people who have grown up in the last 30 years really don't understand that there ever was a time when broadcasters had an obligation to present a variety of viewpoints and not just one. And again, I think, you know, part of what we hear today from people of a conservative bent who complain about the major networks, the cable companies other than Fox, is their complaint is that those are all left-wing, and therefore Fox and AM radio are their only refuges. And I guess my point would be, if that perception is accurate, that's not a good thing from anybody's point of view. But the other problem is that you and I are also talking about media that are getting pushed aside in a very big way for the younger generation. They are not getting their news and information from us. They are getting their news and information from social media and from the big social media companies, which have absolutely no notion of anything remotely resembling the fairness doctrine or the idea of independence in their reporting and commentary.
I've noticed, of course, also simple things like spelling and simple things like grammar, and I'm one of those people that really bugs me. My sense is, how can I trust you as a quote-unquote journalist if you can't even be bothered to proofread, or if you don't even know well enough to structure a grammatical sentence? And yet I realize that many of these outfits that are providing the content that we consume on social media, they maybe don't consider themselves journalists, or at least not by the rigid standards that I think of when I think about journalism.
Well, they often use a term that I loathe, which is content provider. You know, we are providers of content, which suggests that they are basically conduits for data, whether it's accurate or not, and they simply put it out there. I mean, we've heard that kind of rhetoric from Facebook. We've heard that kind of thing from many other social media, and certainly it was the position that WikiLeaks took for many, many years, which was essentially our role is to get information out there, whether it's truthful or not truthful. It's up to you to decide. You know, the idea of, you know, we gather it and we pass it along to you, and you make your own decision. And in a way, of course, that sounds very appealing. And I hear people of many generations say, that's all I want the news media to do. I just want them to give me the information and let me decide for myself. But the danger is that if there's no attempt to vet it for accuracy, then you really can be the purveyor of misinformation and false information and play into the hands of those who have a particular agenda to advance.
In your opinion, how should reputable journalists striving to do the very best by the old standards deal with situations where misinformation is being presented, or in some instances, flat out lies? Anytime this happens from anybody, from any source, what do you do when you need to cover a situation or a person or an organization when what they're saying is not factual?
Well, ideally, of course, you will be correcting that in real time, whether it's in a newspaper or an online news outlet, or if it's in a broadcasting or cable context. I think part of the problem, though, is that it depends on who is providing this misinformation. If it's coming from a governmental entity, particularly the executive branch, I mean, I'm thinking obviously of the president, but it could also be a governor of a state. If they're holding a press conference on, say, COVID-19, there's a legitimate journalistic reason to be covering that in real time. So the question is, what do you do if you have reason to believe or you flat out know that what is being said is not true? And I think, as we've seen in the coverage of some of the presidential press conferences, that the networks and cable channels have been taking, this really Hobson's choice of, do we just stop covering it live and not provide it to the public when there are members of the public that would like to see it immediately? And if we do that, then when we show excerpts and so forth, do we then provide, you know, our take on whether what was said was truthful or not? Or do we cover it live and make it available to the public and then scramble afterwards to try to correct whatever misinformation might be there? And I think it's a terrible situation for the news media to be in when you, you know, have reason to believe that what is being told is not, you know, a good faith mistake, but a deliberate falsehood being told for whatever reason, or being said out of ignorance, but the fact remains it's just not true. I think we used to talk about the role of the news media being the watchdog or the gatekeeper, and I sometimes think that the gatekeeper role has gone by the wayside because of the fact that with a whole variety of other communications media, whether we're talking about social media or just simply the fact that, you know, any state house, governor, president, obviously, can communicate directly with the American public now without even dealing with the mainstream news media. You know, all they have to do is put out a feed from their website, and there it is. So we don't have that same role that we once had, and I think that just puts more pressure on having to be the ones who will hold these people to the fire, who hold their feet to the fire, and be their fact checkers. And, you know, some news organizations have been doing that for some time. The Washington Post, as I'm sure you know, has its Glenn Kessler's Pinocchio ratings when they believe that things that have been said are not true.
And the New York Times publish a list of falsehoods, so they are trying to keep track of this. Something I have noticed on national media and with local media. With local media in the kinds of small communities where I've worked my whole professional life, everybody's really excited about television. One of the things that the national media has elected to do when it comes to school shooters is not show any video of the shooters, is only to cover information about the shooter in written copy that they read, so they're providing the information, but no photographs, no video. Should the news media be more vigilant about dropping the video component?
Well, I think it's certainly true. I mean, just, you know, to drag out another ancient example, when you think back to the Kennedy-Nixon debates, you remember that it was shown that people that watched it on television thought that Kennedy had won, and people that watched it on the radio thought that Nixon had won. I mean, the power of the image is indisputable. And I think, you know, there could be a case made for saying we're going to just drop the video here. You could make that argument, but I truly don't think it's very realistic. I think just looking at the way that political parties campaign these days, you know, it used to be that their essential form of communication to voters was through newspapers. That's become almost irrelevant now. They're communicating either directly from their campaign website, or what are they doing? They're buying time on television to run their ads that have powerful video associated with them. So that video is going to get out there, I guess is my point. And I would rather, I think, have it available for the public to see, hopefully to make their own judgment, rather than just saying you're going to be so overwhelmed by this video that it's basically too incendiary to show to you. I think, to me, it's not an exact comparison or analogy with the school shooting situation, because I think an important aspect there is that, you know, there is research that shows that unstable individuals can be inspired by extensive coverage of these kinds of details, and so some news organizations have chosen for that reason, as well as arguably for reasons of taste, although I think that's a less compelling argument.
I guess
we're not going to show this anymore.
I guess my thought was that there are some unstable individuals in government that are excited about those television cameras, and perhaps if they were not going to get the same kind of platform, they would get a platform but without the video.
I get your point, but I'll tell you why I'm reluctant to go down that road. That is the same argument that has been used for many years to keep cameras out of our courtroom.
Right.
And I'm a proponent of cameras in the courtroom, so I'm afraid I would sound really hypocritical if I agree with you.
I see that. Jane, let me ask you about local media. There are so many things about local media that I wish the public in general knew about local media in terms of how it works. And again, this is in any community across the country. There are a lot of similarities. We, as I mentioned, there was a story in the Trib just a day or so ago about a bunch of local papers going out of business. Why does the public need to care about local media and small local media? And if they care, if they don't like what they're seeing, what can they do? Is there anything that they can do, again, in this era of consolidation and the removal of local stations? Thank you again, 1980s, stripping back of different protections from the FCC. What can people do? Can they do anything that'll make a difference?
Well, I'd like to address the first part of your question first, which is what do we lose when we lose local media? And I mean, I know you know the answer to this, but I think it's worth repeating. We lose the finger on the pulse of the community in a very real way. You know, what your local town council is doing, you know, what's happening at your school board meetings. Yes, of course, they're typically public. I mean, these days they're probably all via Zoom, but the point is you could go, but most people are not going to have the time to do that. Unless there's some compelling reason affecting their family directly, they're not going to do that. But you need somebody to keep an eye on what's going on with the government. I saw an interesting quote today, as it happens, from a reporter in the Orlando Sentinel who was talking about the fact that she was an education reporter. She said, if I write a story about the fact that half the kids in the marching band can't afford to pay the rental fee to get their band instruments, that could inspire people to get into their closets and dig out their old clarinets and flutes and lend them or donate them to the school. Now, that may not seem like a life and death issue, but it is in the sense that it's the lifeblood of the community, and I think you lose that when you lose local print reporting and local broadcasters as well. The question about what you can do about it is a much more difficult one because, of course, there is continuing discussion about consolidation of the media and ownership and cross-ownership and things like that. Given the current Federal Communications Commission, I would say there's absolutely zero chance that anything is going to change in that regard. It's possible that with a Democratic majority there might be some changes, but I'm not entirely sure that it's solely a regulatory issue in the FCC context. It's almost more of an antitrust issue, I think, going beyond the specifics of the broadcast community. The trouble is that it has such an impact on public knowledge, public participation, and frankly, public health and safety, because as you know, there have been many reports of some of these, outpost radio stations that are held by a huge conglomerate who have basically dropped the ball on things like tornado warnings and so forth for their community because they don't really operate there. I mean, they nominally do, but they don't have any personnel there. So this is a serious issue, and I guess the only thing I can say is that if people are concerned about it from a regulatory standpoint, they need to be letting their representatives in Congress know that they'd like to see more oversight of what the FCC is doing.
And if you have local media who you believe is doing good work, talk about that. Let people know. Educate them, I think, about the importance of this service in a community. Obviously, working at a community public radio station, it's part of our mission. It's what we do. And so we're very committed to it. But wherever the local media is that you think is doing a good job, let your friends and family know, educate them, explain to them how things work. Jane, thank you so much. I wish we had more time. Obviously, this is an issue that is near and dear to my heart, but thank you so very much for taking some time this morning to talk to us about it. Really appreciate that, and hope we have the opportunity to talk again soon.
Thank you so much, and I do too. Thanks.
Jane Kirtley joined us this morning on Neighbors. She is the Silla Professor of Media Ethics and Law with the Hubbard School of Journalism and Mass Communication at the University of Minnesota and the director of the Silla Center for the Study of Media Ethics and Law.
If you need me, I want you to call me. Steelers call me. Don't wait too long. If things go wrong, I'll hurry home.
It's 10:22. And this is Neighbors on KUMD. Joining us this morning is Dan Williams. He is the executive director of the Red Cross. He's also a board member of Douglas and St. Louis County Emergency Food and Shelter Programs. Hey, Dan, good morning, and thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
St. Louis County has received roughly $200,000 in CARES money, the Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Security Act, and also some additional money as the St. Louis County Board to help agencies get funds to expand the capacity of food and shelter programs in high-need areas. The priority is to fund food and shelter. So my first question for you, I guess, is what can $200,000 do in our community for some of our vulnerable residents?
Well, I can do a lot. So it's an interesting program. It's a program that's been around for, gosh, about 15, 20 years or so, called the Emergency Food and Shelter Program, funded through FEMA, actually, and it's for non-disaster-related emergency feeding and sheltering. So the Red Cross happens to be one of the national partners of this program, as does Salvation Army, as does Jewish Family Services, some other places like that. So it's an important part to have representation from the community on this to actually decide where this funding goes. So it's a really interesting federal program in that this money is allocated nationally. So each year they have a round, they call it. And so, like in this case for St. Louis County, this year's round of funding would have been $85,000. But because of the coronavirus impact, massive unemployment, massive demands and stretches on food insecurity organizations and sheltering stuff, they add an additional $121,000. So there's $206,000 just for St. Louis County alone. And what's fascinating about this program is they sort of allocate that money to the county, and then local county organizations, community members, community leaders, regular citizens decide where should this money go. And so any organization that's eligible for federal funding can apply for this. So you have to be a nonprofit. You have to be able to be eligible for federal funding and that kind of thing. But many of our local community organizations certainly are. And so, so this type of funding goes to places like food shelves, like soup kitchen type organizations, like our emergency shelters, like domestic violence resource places. And so it's a really great program with literally 2% administrative costs. So almost all of this money is going directly into food and services for people at risk in our communities.
We are blessed in this community to have a lot of those great organizations working to help people all across the spectrum. The issue of homelessness and helping to get people housed and cared for is one that we've talked about quite a bit on this program. It can get caught up in some bureaucratic and administrative red tape. It is made complicated, of course, by some folks with ongoing substance abuse or mental health issues. That's really a sticky wicket under the best of times. As different groups have talked about, and as people have been watching the community and observing and listening to folks talk, where are they saying the need is? And do people have some ideas for innovative programs or things they could do or that they think would really help?
Well, I think there's two things. So one is the more things change, the more they stay the same, right? So right now we've got this really horrible situation. The data just showed, came out on Tuesday, that 40% of all households of less than 40,000 total household income had a layoff in their household just in March. That's stunning, right? So we've got this really unique, rapid increase in the amount of households that have had a massive income reduction. But there's also similarities, right? So before coming to the Red Cross 6 years ago, I actually worked for Lutheran Social Service of Minnesota. And so I literally talked to thousands of households going through the foreclosure crisis during the Great Recession. When the floods of 2012 came in the Duluth and much surrounding areas, I talked to hundreds of people who had devastating impact by that flooding. And one of the things that really I've learned over the years of working with people around these sorts of crises is that a lot of times people will try holding on. They'll try sort of gutting it out. And, you know, my experience tells me if you've had an income reduction, you're having financial stress, get help. You know, I think a lot of times in society and media, we talk about, oh, people abuse the social service system, or people are just trying to get something for free. But my experience in the nonprofit world is that many more people really could use, and in the long run would much benefit our communities by accessing some of these social services than trying to sort of pull themselves up by their bootstraps, right? And so we really want to encourage people that, you know, so two things. One, if you need help, try finding access to help. If you're one of these organizations, you know, ask for help as volunteers, as donations. If you're an individual person that hasn't been impacted by income loss from this, you're financially secure, man, there's no better time than right now to donate money to your local food shelf, your local nonprofit, because there is a massive strain happening in that system right now. And so this funding is really great news to help with a burden that really needs lots of help right now.
You know, Dan, there's been a lot of conversations about creating more supportive housing, about creating a housing trust fund. I'm kind of pulling thoughts and concepts out of my mind from over the years of these discussions. Would any of this money be available to help make some of those programs that could address ongoing issues a reality, or are there conditions or strings attached that kind of narrow the scope of how it can be used?
This funding is actually pretty narrowly scoped, but it's interesting. While this funding has to be used for food or immediate emergency shelter, right, what it does is it might free up resources at some of these organizations that might have a little bit more flexibility than with their other sources of income, you know, their other grants or other donations that come in, to do some of that longer-term creative planning. And so, you know, while all money isn't fungible, right, you can't use it for every different thing, resources coming into organizations that do good things helps them do good things. And so, you know, there's lots of things going on right now. There's lots of structural inequalities that we see that right now a bright spotlight is being shined on, right? So we have so many people that, you know, don't have tons of paid time off in their job, don't have jobs that they can just have the luxury of getting the same pay and working from home. I think a lot of times we see things about, you know, we're all in this together. And I just heard one of my great colleagues say, you know, we all may be in the same boat, but we're not going through the same storm. You know, so I think a lot of the inequalities that exist, a lot of the housing struggles that we see, a lot of structural racism and that kind of thing, you know, those are all long-term things that really need to be dealt with. But it's great to be able to have good news and be able to encourage, you know, our nonprofits to say that there's some help out there, you know, and anything that any of us can do to help is a good thing.
Dan, thank you so very much for taking some time to talk with us this morning. Unfortunately, we're out of time, but we'll get some links up on our website so folks know who they can contact to get additional information and how they can go about educating themselves about this program, and maybe how to get a hold of Dan if they say, you know, I'd like to volunteer, or I'd like to donate, or I'd like to help. Let me know what I can do, where I can direct my time and energy and money. Dan, thanks again for joining us this morning.
Absolutely. Be safe and have a great day, everybody.
Dan Williams is the executive director of the Red Cross, and he's a board member for Douglas and St. Louis County Emergency Food and Shelter Programs. He joined us this morning as our guest on Neighbors here on KUMD.